Good afternoon. I'm Claire Coleman from the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. I'm going to moderate this afternoon's panel on the Safety Net and the Affordable Care Act. When the slides come up, it means the recorder's on, so the session is going to start. We have three panelists today. I'm counting myself. As I mentioned, I'm the president of the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. NFRA represents the publicly funded family planning providers all around the country, 400-plus institutions that are working to subsidize family planning and sexual health care for the poor, low-income, and underserved. We represent county health departments, hospital-based family planning, independent private not-for-profits, the Planned Parenthood system, and many, many provider systems. We are 41 this year. We have two panelists joining us. Bill Smith, of course, the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors, who we have heard from a number of times throughout the conference. Bill and I have known each other about 15 years. Started working together when Bill was the vice president of public policy at the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, on which board I have served. He's currently completing his doctoral degree in political philosophy, and he's a guest lecturer at the University of New Mexico, something we all deeply envy him for. He's doing extraordinary work at NCSD, and we're very proud at NFRA to be a close partner to NCSD. And Kevin Cranston's with us. We all heard from Kevin this morning. He's the director of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health Bureau of Infectious Disease and used to run the HIV/AIDS Bureau. He's an expert, of course, in HIV/AIDS and is on the board of the National Coalition for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Health, as well as the past chair of NASTAD, the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. So we've got a nice panel. Their bios are actually in the book for you to take a look at. I also did want to mention that prior to my time at NFRA, I was a Planned Parenthood affiliate CEO in the state of New York, running a $9 million system serving 35,000 men, women, and teens in four counties, 2 hours north of New York City. So when I talk about the safety net, I talk about it not only from the Washington advocacy perspective, but from the perspective of someone who's actually been out there delivering care. So our job today, I'll just give you a brief sense of where we're going. We're going to walk you through the patient path through the Affordable Care Act. So this is not about what's in the bill. It's more about sort of where will patients go in terms of payer when they enter our systems following the ACA. We're going to talk about our definition of the safety net. Jeff Levy gave us the definition this morning. We're going to talk about what we conceive a safety net to be and how we think the safety net is going to work. And we're going to make a case for the need, the continued need for safety net. Kevin's then going to focus on, again, the experience in Massachusetts, what's it like to transition, put your safety net system through a transition, and identify some key areas of focus for us. And then we're going to look at some reimagined roles, particularly for the health departments, what their role will be as we reimagine the safety net. And again, throughout the presentation, there'll be a chance for questions and dialogue. Because it's a small panel and we have a lot of time, we do hope and would appreciate a lot of engagement from you in the conversation we're going to have today. You were cheering? Okay, so I'm going to start by just saying a couple things that will help us set up what's the patient's path through the ACA. So I think the first thing that is important to know from our perspective when we're thinking about patient care is that the Affordable Care Act is insurance reform. It's not payment reform, it's not cost reform, and it's not structural reform, meaning it doesn't look at the provider network and reorganize it in a way that would make sense for the future. It really just gets at reforming some insurance protections. So we think of this as a moment in time. While the Affordable Care Act feels like it's going to change everything, I would argue that Title X in 1970 was health insurance reform, and the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program is health insurance reform. And Medicare prescription drugs is health reform. And the CHIP program in the 90s was health reform. The fact is that as long as the government has a primary payer role in the world of healthcare, we are going to continue to see the political process do health reform. And I think for our folks, it's much easier to think about this as being yet another moment in time. This is definitely not the end, particularly because the ACA isn't payment reform, it isn't cost reform, and it isn't structural reform. So for those of you who are in it for the long haul, You need to be thinking about 8-10 years from now, when the government's going to be back at it, trying to continue to make tweaks and changes to the system. That's sort of our experience of working in the safety net, and that's the experience of how healthcare services are delivered and paid for in the United States. So here are some key questions. People are really focused on what's going to happen to the 32 million people who are going to get access to care under the Affordable Care Act. That number, 32 million, comes from the government. The expectation is that about half of those folks will gain eligibility to the Medicaid program, and the other half will gain access to insurance through the commercial insurance exchanges that are going to be run by states. So the importance of a network is really going to be big here. There's going to be a need for folks who are coming into the system, coming into eligibility, perhaps for the first time, to be educated and sort of oriented towards using insurance. And our speakers this morning alluded to this, but I don't know about you, but I learned how to use health insurance by following my mother into the pediatrician's office and watching her put a white card on a counter, and she would say, "We have a 2 o'clock with Dr. Welby." That's a learned behavior. And for millions of people today, their learned behavior is waiting for 8 to 10 hours in urgent care. That's their learned behavior. So this idea that people are going to get eligibility and therefore begin to use insurance, I think, doesn't make any sense to us. And I would also argue that if I asked you all right now to take out your wallets and remove your white cards, most of you couldn't explain to me what your insurance actually covers. So this idea that even if you were raised in a family or in an environment where you had access to insurance, that you get it and you know how to use your insurance appropriately is a little bit of a gap that I think we're gonna confront. The safety net, more than any other setting, is gonna confront this. Because for millions of our patients, they've never known what it's like to have a white card. I don't think they're always white, but aren't they always white? I think so. Okay, so who's gonna provide care? This is an extraordinarily tough, challenging issue all across the health spectrum. We have a workforce shortage across the system of healthcare in every category of clinician. In family planning, sexual health, we have a particular challenge in that our systems are run primarily by nurse practitioners, so it's different from the STD system. Our system is run by nurse practitioners, and more than half of the nurse practitioners currently working in our settings would like to retire. A number of them aren't retiring because of the recession. So in this one single way, the bad economy is actually helping us, because we're holding on to people who have to work longer than they might want to. But workforce is going to be an extraordinary challenge, and it's leading to new questions for the safety net about scope of practice, particularly. Because there will not be enough providers to see all the people in need of care, we have to think anew about the breadth of training and the scope of practice assigned to individual clinician categories. That's mostly state-based work. So for those of you in the room who are working in state government, this is a very important issue to engage in and be cognizant of. The need to challenge scope of practice, to get people working at what we call the top of their scope, will become more and more important as more people become eligible for health care under the Affordable Care Act. And then finally, there's this question of, will there be enough providers? And the answer is no. There will not be enough providers, period. Period. Which is why when at the federal level we work on workforce, a lot of us are really focused on the pipeline problem, which is it costs a lot of money and takes a lot of time to bring someone through a training program at whatever level of degree they're shooting for, or whatever level of practice they're working towards. And so there's a lot of effort and attention and energy towards putting a lot of money into what is relatively few practitioners. Costs a lot to train a doctor. For the first time under the Affordable Care Act, we're introducing graduate nursing education. There's never been graduate nursing education, only graduate medical education. So there's more of a sense that the nursing workforce is going to be extraordinarily important, and that the federal government has to infuse some resources. But the pipeline takes forever to loosen, right, or to have more people flowing through. And one of the things we continue to see, and there was just a story in the New York Times about this last week, is that there are people waiting on waiting lists to get into nursing programs. They want to train, but they cannot get in. And one of the key issues there is the seniority and the educational attainment of the nurse training workforce. Most nurse practitioners now are PhD prepared. but we don't have enough practitioners who are PhD prepared who are willing to go back into the classroom and teach. Partially that has to do with salary. So we've got a problem in that we need to make sure our current workforce is as trained as they can possibly be and are working at the broadest scope, but then we have to make sure that enough people are getting in the pipeline. So when I go around the country, I always argue that if you know anyone, they should be going to nursing school. Okay, so patient path. These are the paths, essentially. This is what the ACA envisions, okay? So two things to know about the ACA. It's completely silent on the safety net. The ACA doesn't say anything at all about the categorical grant programs that we've all been working under, just silent. And the ACA doesn't have anything to say about the millions of people who will still be left out. So while this is an extraordinary achievement, in my judgment, for the public health, 32 million Americans covered, if it goes well, the federal government's own data tell us that nearly 50 million people went without health insurance sometime in the last year, and that number's been growing, of course, as the recession has gotten worse. So even if the government implements the ACA, and even if state governments implement the ACA just perfectly, we're still talking about upwards of 20 million people who will be left out. A chunk of those folks are either in the country illegally or are citizens, but they can't prove their citizenship. Those folks are, that is silent. The Affordable Care Act is silent on all those folks. It's not silent on this idea that you'll go into Medicaid or into the exchanges. So just a couple of words about this, because we heard about it from Jeff this morning. The threshold for getting into the Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act is an income of $14,800, which I think we all might argue is a very low income. That's the new ceiling in the Medicaid program. And here's the kicker. 40 states of the 50 are not as generous as that now. 40 states have to grow their Medicaid programs to be as generous as an income threshold of $14,800 a year. That's the income you would need to qualify automatically for the Medicaid program. If your income is above that threshold, you are expected to go into the commercial insurance exchanges and purchase insurance. And if your income is between $14,800 and roughly $44,000, these are individual incomes, not family incomes, the government will subsidize your purchase. You'll contribute a part of your premium, but the government will subsidize your purchase of insurance. That's what the exchanges are meant to do. Give people access to quality insurance products and subsidize their access to those products. So the safety net for me is everything in the middle. The fact is many safety net systems, not all, many safety net systems today see a Medicaid population, they see an uninsured or underinsured population, and they see a commercially or privately insured population. So that big circle you see with the question mark in it, that's the safety net to me. So this morning, Jeff Levy said in his opening remarks that the safety net were the community health center systems. And I dispute that. I would say that our definition of the safety net needs to be that you take public money to subsidize care for poor, low-income, underserved, or marginalized people. That's what the safety net is and does. That does not mean that those of us working in the safety net do not participate in insurance. So it's not about one kind of setting, and it's not about this dichotomy of we take insurance or we don't. Under the Affordable Care Act, we're all going to take insurance, particularly because of that explosive growth of the Medicaid program. But this is where we see the safety net sitting. Okay, just a couple more things about the safety net, and then I'm going to ask my colleagues to join in. So we have a lot of evidence that patients are going to continue to seek care in the safety net. Again, in many places, we're accepting Medicaid and commercial insurance now. The post-health reform studies in Massachusetts, and this is Kaiser data, show that in safety net settings, like hospitals, community health settings, the patient visits actually rose pretty dramatically in the 3 or 4 years following health reform. So people obtain insurance and still are going to come into safety net settings, still will seek access in safety net settings. And I just wanted to make one more point about, particularly about family planning. In the Title X family planning system, we've seen 170,000 new patients in the last 2 years alone. That right now is being driven by the recession. People are tumbling out of jobs and insurance, and they're tumbling into lower income categories. And they're walking into the safety net, in some cases for the very first time. In other cases, they're coming back to us after many years away. And they're seeking care that they know they can trust. So we do think there are going to be really good opportunities for the safety net to continue to provide care to people all across the income spectrum, but with particular interest and emphasis on those who are joining the insurance system for the first time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Smith to talk a little bit about his concept of safety net, how they fit together, and where we go from here.
Thanks, Claire. That was a really great overview. And let me also admit that I love the two people that I'm bookended by up here. And both of them are quite brilliant and have admittedly much more practical experience in this sphere than I do. I as I was sitting here, I started rewriting my notes because I think I want to start with where I was going to end, which is what keeps me up at night. And why, when Claire and I first started talking about this panel, I was excited about it. And let me tell you what keeps me up at night. And I see my lead federal policy person sitting in the back there. What keeps me up at night is that when NCSD is up on Capitol Hill, meeting with members of Congress, so we're meeting with the Office of Management and Budget staff that deals with the discretionary money that we rely on for sexual health safety net services, and by that I mean family planning, STDs, HIV, viral hepatitis. When we have been meeting with those folks since the passage of the ACA, we have consistently heard messages that, are they doing billing and reimbursement? Are they seeking all the money they can? Because we are looking to cut your money. So this isn't a theoretical exercise on what the safety net looks like. In fact, what it's about is a spirited defense of what it looks like. Because I think most recently, there was a very serious conversation with that was very directive and said, we're looking to cut your budgets. So get ready. Now, we're going to do, along with our partners, everything we possibly can to make sure that doesn't happen. But it actually involves a whole lot of dialectic and back and forth advocacy and innovation outside of Washington. So that's what keeps me up at night, and it's why I think we have to focus on what the safety net looks like. And I think Claire started with some definitional stuff, and pardon me for sort of being the political philosophy dork that I am, but I don't think the definition of the safety net is also all that difficult. Lincoln had a definition for religion. He said, a very famous one that you've probably heard before, when I do good, I feel good, and when I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. Now, there's a whole lot of detail in there, sort of what's bad, what's good, is it all subjective? There's a lot of detail there. But I think it's a pretty simple working definition that occurred to me. The safety net's pretty simple, right? Which is, people need services that they can't get anywhere else for a host of different reasons: stigma, discrimination, costs, access, a host of different issues. But sort of that's the bottom line, which is that there's a host of services that people need in the safety net because they can't access them elsewhere. And I think Claire touched on this a little bit. I know you guys did this morning, which is that I think what concerns me most about the discussion about the persistence of the safety net when it comes to STDs is we have focused, or even more generally, is that we focused almost exclusively on the percent of the population that's going to continue to be uninsured, and that's the 22 to 27 million people, which is not a small amount, you know, just under 10. I checked the census calculation clock on the government website before I came down, and it was 313,136,000 and change. So it's about 10% of the population that is still going to continue to be uninsured. And you know, the safety net is something far more expansive to that group of people than STD services. But what concerns me is that if we're speaking specifically about the sensitive sexual health services that we all know are not showing up at the urgent care center because you've got a sore throat or something like that, the safety net, I think, is something very different. There's a reason it's called intimate behavior, right? The definition of intimate is very private or personal. And to think that in 3 years' time, there is going to be a complete shift in the way humans function when it comes to sex and seeking out health care for those behaviors is stupid. And when my policy person comes back to the office and says, well, they said everyone's going to go to their primary care doctors for their STD services, I'm like, oh, my God. So we have got a huge problem here because the people who fund the safety net in Washington are making assumptions that are completely incompatible with human experience. That's not good. That's not good. So what does that mean, I think, for the future of the STD safety net? And Claire does, and I hope I'm not going to stomp. Are you doing viable pathways?
Nope.
No. See, we talk together. We do way too many of these things together. So Claire has this whole wonderful presentation where she talks about viable pathways. So I wanted to talk about briefly viable pathways for STD services, STD safety net services under the Affordable Care Act. So we discussed some of these in the last session that we were in, and Claire touched on them. So federally qualified health centers are undoubtedly the winner under the Affordable Care Act. It is not a categorical program, whether it's an STD categorical program, an HIV categorical program, or a categorical family planning program. So one option is to work with your federally qualified health centers so that they're doing the STD-related services. That takes a host of different configurations, and some of you are familiar with them. It is co-location of services. It is contract and agreements that perhaps have you doing reciprocal relationships around patients. But the one that I want to talk most about today, and I do this with some trepidation because my friend Matt Golden is in the back of the room, and he does this much better than me, is a spirited defense of the categorical STD clinic, which has become really fallen out of fashion, I think, in many ways. But I think what we have to recognize is that because sexual health services and STD services are so sensitive, and because, as Kevin presented this morning for those of you who were there, that you have to go through some extraordinary means to deal with a syphilis infection, that you've got to figure out who's carrying bicillin and how you get medications transferred across. And I thought it was a very novel idea. But there's a specialized service that's provided in these clinics. And we have to figure out a way to both pursue the paths that the Affordable Care Act sets in front of us to mainstream sexual health services, including STDs, and that means partnering with federally qualified health centers and other settings like emergency departments. But it also means that we don't throw in the towel on categorical STD clinics, where, in fact, they are pivotal, trusted members of the community. And Claire talks a lot about this when it comes to family planning, and she's spot on. Family planning providers have become trusted providers of the services they provide. And we should not negate the fact that STD clinics, categorical STD clinics, are similarly relied upon for the services that they currently provide, particularly for men. Another question came up in our previous session, which is, well, what are we going to do with this new influx of men that are going to be covered under the Affordable Care Act? And I think when it comes to STD services, it doesn't mean anything different, except that we've got to make sure someone's providing them services. So if it's not the categorical STD clinic, absolutely the state or local health department, I think, has a role in ensuring those services are provided. So I just got the time that I'm up, and really we just wanted to throw some ideas out to you all so that we can have a robust discussion. But let me finish where Claire started, which is where I was going to start, but then I switched things around, which is that in defending the safety net, and in particular the provision of STD services wherever they're provided, what we have to recognize is, as Claire said, that the Affordable Care Act is just the reform of health insurance. It's not the reform of, it's not true health care reform. But most importantly, what that underscores for me is that this is still being discussed as a commodity and not a right. So for me, this is not an NCSD position, because I know there's some board members in the room. This is not an NCSD position, but for me, the trajectory is around the rights-based discourse, which is virtually non-existent when we talk about STD services. But the truth is that what the safety net underscores is that people have a right to those services and we have a responsibility to provide them for us. So with that, I'll sort of stop and are we turning? Yeah, with that, I'll stop. Yeah.
We're going to see if there's questions. Are there questions for Bill or for me? People take a while to warm up to me. I've addressed all of your concerns. Really, I'm that good. Okay. Oh, we got one.
All right. I don't know if this fits, but I do have a question with the exchange or Medicaid. Is there discussion or in the plans that behaviors would be penalized or incentivized to make people healthier? And I have a concern about the penalizing of a behavior if they're in an exchange or Medicaid or, do you know what I'm trying to ask?
I think so.
I haven't heard anything, but I'm thinking that might be next.
So I'm going to try to answer the question in two ways, because one is just about having or enrolling in insurance. So will there be incentives or penalties for either having or not having insurance? Under the ACA, there are, in fact, penalties for not having insurance. This is linked to the individual mandate. And the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act is one of the key issues that the Supreme Court is going to debate, not next week, but the week after, when they hear oral arguments in the case that claims that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. So there are provisions in the Affordable Care Act that would penalize both individuals and businesses that right now offer insurance to their employees if they were to drop that coverage. We've been focusing a fair amount at NIFRA on the business part. So, you know, NIFRA is a small business, and we offer insurance to our 9 employees, and we pay 80 or 90% of the cost of that care. So under the Affordable Care Act, they do envision that a number of small businesses like NIFRA would drop their health insurance coverage. And that's because the penalty to businesses is actually lower in almost every case than the cost of providing insurance to their employers. So there are some business penalties, and then there are individual penalties, as there are in Massachusetts. If you don't carry insurance in Massachusetts, there's a tax penalty, essentially. In terms of behavioral penalties or incentives, there have been conversations about that outside the public policy context in the larger health research and behavioral health area, talking about whether or not you can incentivize better health choices. So some examples that we've heard of do in fact involve insurance. For example, if you're a non-smoker and you work in a large company, your company might give you a better rate for your portion of your health insurance if you're not smoking, or if you commit to quit smoking. They might incentivize you by lowering your health insurance rate, or they might penalize you if you are a smoker and you don't want to consider quitting or you can't, by raising the amount that you contribute towards your health insurance. So there is some discussion in sort of the health economist field about, are there ways to impact behavior using monetary incentives? And certainly in other areas of health and incentives have worked. Penalties and incentives have worked. So I think you will hear researchers and economists, those who are actuarial and putting together tables, maybe thinking about that more. It hasn't really hit the hill yet and been a serious public policy conversation. Yes.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase the question, but with the legal challenge in front of the Supreme Court right now, what impact will that have on other forms of insurance such as Medicare, because that is a required deduction on people's paycheck right now?
Mm-hmm. So the Medicaid expansion is an issue in the Supreme Court case, which is unusual. So what we think we know about the Supreme Court is that they take legal issues where the lower courts have been in conflict. The lower courts have absolutely been in conflict about the constitutionality of the individual mandate on this question of, can the government force you to purchase health insurance? That's what the individual mandate is about. And there was a clash in the system. So the court took that question. But the court voluntarily reached out and said, we're going to take the question of whether or not the Medicaid expansion is constitutional. That was not an issue in any of the lower court cases. So the fact that the Supreme Court reached for it and said, we're going to decide that as well, is worrisome to quite a lot of people. There's a lot of history in case law on the idea that the federal government, using its rules and its money, can incentivize behavior. Technically, Medicaid is a voluntary program. States don't have to participate in it. And in fact, Texas is modeling right now what it might look like if you walk from pieces of the Medicaid program. But Medicaid is technically voluntary. The feds put up half the money at least, and in some cases nearly all the money, and they set most of the rules. And the states then put up some share of funds, and they do all the implementation. So it's not a 50-50 partnership. It's really more heavily weighted towards the federal side of the question, but it is a voluntary partnership. And so this question is one of the key ones that the Supreme Court will take, and we just don't know what the implications will be. If they follow history, the Medicaid expansion will stand.
I was talking more specifically about Medicare, because that is mandated.
Medicare is a fully federal program.
Correct.
So there is no implication for states. They cover all the costs. They do all of the work. That's the difference.
But individuals do pay in.
Correct. Individuals do contribute. They get more than the value of what they put in. But the program is wholly federal. The rules are set federally. The program is paid for federally. There's no state involvement. So there will be no implications for the Medicare program, even if the government, even if the court decides that the Medicaid expansion is unconstitutional.
Weren't there legal challenges at its inception, however?
You should speak in the microphone if you're going to.
I'm not a specialist in this area. I believe there were legal challenges in the 60s at the time of implementation, and it survived, court ruling at that time.
Medicare. Yeah, and Medicaid has survived similar challenges. That's why I'm saying if they follow history, the Medicaid expansion will stand. Does that help? There's just no state involvement here, so there's no state challenge to the Medicare program. There are threats to Medicare, but they're all coming federally. It's the federal government that's threatening the future of the Medicare program, not state government.
I wouldn't be surprised if court decisions supporting the constitutionality of Medicare when it was put into place will be put before by the administration in support of the ACA.
Right, but basically the oversimplified version is that Medicare is mandated as a federal program, such as, the Affordable Health Care Act.
I know.
And that's kind of the gray area.
Can I have one quick comment? We had a discussion with a constitutional scholar, and one of the key things is that the federal government can issue a tax, which is no question about the constitutionality. The administration did not want to pose this as a tax. If they posed it as a tax, it would have been no problem. They didn't want to get caught in the political wrangling of having a tax.
Of taxing.
At this point, Medicare is a tax. Structured as a tax is not a challenge to the constitutionality of that as a program.
Thanks, Tim. And if there's any lawyer who wants to get out and battle this up, you're certainly welcome to head to the mic. Ma'am, please.
I had a question that came up concerning, part of what we do depends a lot on confidentiality. And a question that came up to me from a provider last week was asking about what would they do, what about the confidentiality issue of it, with patients coming in, having to report, when the insurance is being applied, about parents getting, information on their children, that sort of thing. I wasn't quite sure how to answer that for her. They're actually trying to bill right now, and she was trying to figure out how that would work. Does anybody have any ideas?
I made a couple of comments about that in my plenary this morning. I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is a function of primarily federal rules, but also state rules. And this is consumer law, essentially. The ways in which you know how your insurance has been used, and as a cross-check, because you often don't see the bill that went to the insurer, you only see the explanation of benefits, the EOB. Okay. The EOB, under law, has to tell you all the procedures. Now, it's still fairly inscrutable for many of us to figure out exactly what each of those charges ties to in terms of your activities. But a large number of laboratory procedures and certainly surgical procedures or any other, you know, office-based procedure need to be fully explained to you, because that's your insurance that's paying for that procedure, even though you didn't get a bill on it. So on the one hand, there's a great value as a consumer holding, you know, insurance that you see that you're the benefit that you got for that insurance. On the other hand, however, if you're the insurer, I'm a parent. My daughter's 21. She's in college. When she goes to her college health service, I get the EOB because it's my insurance she's being paid for. And that is currently what will happen, because that is my right under the law to see what services she received, even if I don't want to know. You know, and believe me, sometimes I don't. You know, it's our relationship. I'm an askable parent, and, you know, but I want her to be able to seek healthcare services through the mechanism. She has her insurance card, but it's because I'm an employee of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that she has that insurance. This is a serious challenge for a number of conditions and procedures for individuals who openly state to us, and we have some literature, some data, you know, being shared at this conference, that they do not want to use their insurance because some member of their household, whether it's a parent in the case of an underage individual, or a spouse, or someone else who might open the mail in the household, would see the EOB and know that they've sought this service for this condition or concern that they want to keep confidential. One of the recommendations I was making this morning, and I've heard echoed by many folks in the field, is that we need a mechanism for lowering the level of reveal for certain laboratory procedures and certain office-based procedures for certain stigmatized conditions, not to limit our rights as consumers, but to actually encourage the members of our families who might use those rights to fully access them with some level of privacy and confidentiality. So it's a balancing of different concerns. But right now, yes, whoever is the holder of the insurance policy has the right to know how that insurance was used, and that will be disclosed.
That's going to be a huge deterrent for teenagers to come into the clinic.
So we're working on that at the federal policy level, and there's a number of groups engaged in the mental health community and the sexual health community across a broad range of health conditions. There is concern. But I do want to say that there have been interventions or solutions that have been tried in different insurance systems. So Kevin's remarks were all about people with insurance, people with commercial insurance who have the little white card. In the Medicaid program, there have been workarounds to protect people from having the explanation of benefits sent home. And a lot of these things are going to be worked out in states, but there's also some federal guidance that could help. So groups like NIFRA have partnered with Planned Parenthood and many other organizations around the country to submit to the government recommendations about how you can there be a confidential code? Can there be no explanation of benefits, particularly for preventive services? If they are of no cost to the consumer, do you really need an explanation of benefits? So what the community has done in coalition is get together and present the federal government with a range of options and choices to say, this is what we think would be good quality care. It does the most to protect confidentiality. But we do have some examples from other insurance systems to draw on. We're not without resources here. Okay. And we're not alone. The sexual health community is not alone, and it's not limited just to adolescents.
Is it possible, you know, for me to see some of those examples?
Sure, absolutely. NIFRA's done a paper. We've done a series of comments on it. I know a lot of our partners have done similar things so that folks can see what the options are. And we're always happy to share the comments that we gave to the federal government. So if you want to come see us at the end, we'll connect.
And I just want to, I really want to underscore what Claire said, which is that in most instances, and there is the hope that there's something that can be done federally. But most of this is going to be worked out at the state level. So I think what's critically important as we move forward are two things. First, that an enormous amount of advocacy has to happen at the state level to figure out what the delivery of the explanation of benefits looks like. The EOB, as most of you know, goes home to prevent fraud. That's the reason it goes. It's not to say, here's the codes of what you had. Those don't mean anything to any of us. It's to say, someone used your health insurance, and here's how much it cost. That's why it goes home. So there are some other novel ways for the delivery of the explanation of benefits that at least provide some increased privacy, such as not a paper one going home that we've seen in other jurisdictions work out. So I think that's piece number one, which is advocacy at the state level on this is absolutely critical. And as Claire said, there's some really good work going on, and DSTDP is actually investing in some of that. The second piece, which is why I continue to underscore why discretionary resources are so important as a supplement to the diversification of resources that have to be critical to the provision of sexual health-related services, mm-hmm. is that until we get to the point, which is not going to happen by 2014, where the confidentiality issue is solved, discretionary resource can supplement the delivery of services in a confidential fashion that doesn't make everyone bankrupt or put, you know, close clinics down. So that mixture of resources, I think, is absolutely critical for a host of reasons, but in particular until we figure this piece out, so that the adolescent or the, what did you use this morning, the 35-year-old rich married guy
cheating on his wife,
whoever, so that those services can be provided.
Yeah, I'm more concerned with the adolescents.
Sure.
Because they might not see care.
Correct. There's a big disincentive. Right. But there are, as I mentioned, solutions. I see Gail Bernstein in the line behind you, and I bet she's anxious to have a chance to address this issue. But, you know, in some cases, the explanation of benefits are sent to the health center, not to the residents. You know, there are ways that this has been negotiated in order to protect access to care and confidentiality. You're welcome.
Yeah, just to add to the discussion on this, because I'm working with the National Chlamydia Coalition and Gail Bernstein behind me on this. Under Medicaid, when there's no cost sharing, virtually all the states have figured out a way to suppress the EOB through a variety of mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that has mostly happened at the state level through insurance commissions.
Correct.
With various and sundry ways. So there are lots of examples for that. And in the expansion of Medicaid, there's no reason to think that that would not
change.
Also be included. But in the private insurance world, that's another thing. Now, under Medicaid, there is a requirement for some explanation of benefits for fraud purposes, but the EOB is not mandated to be that mechanism. You just have to have a mechanism to avoid fraud,
mm-hmm.
but over time it's become the EOB.
Yeah.
But that is absolutely not mandated under Medicaid. But under the commercial insured, it's going to be another thing, because even with the plans that would be available, they range from 90% to 60% coverage. So there's 10 to 40% copay or deductible. There's some kind of cost sharing for those services that aren't covered. And you were all co-signatures on a letter that cites HIPAA's endangerment clause.
Correct.
Where that's intended to say no EOBs to go home, and to take adolescents even out of it. In the case of potential domestic violence, a spouse can say nothing can be sent to home, and the plan must comply.
Mm-hmm.
But that would mean that adolescents would need to know to invoke that when they sought services. And that's quite the thing to try to get out. So some other mechanisms that have been considered were things like code modifiers to the AMA and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But my guess is that it will be state by state, more like you said, because it's the insurance commissions within the state that have the power about how to institute those roles. Although I think there needs to be the federal push,
as much as coordination as possible,
you know,
sure.
for that. But it's really going to reside in the state. And even though all that insurance coverage is there, there will be cost sharing. And any policyholder does have the right to have some explanation why they got a bill for $150.
Absolutely.
So if the adolescent or whomever can pay and do that, then there wouldn't need to be anything going home. But all the institutions are going to want to recover that cost in some way, because there's such cost pressure on it. So, you know, it really is an issue, and not just for adolescents, because now the expansion's to age 26, as you've pointed out. So often college health or wherever, mm-hmm. there's likely to be a cost sharing for a variety of sensitive services.
Correct. And we're starting to get these questions, or similar questions, from the folks in states who are working on the setups of their exchanges. You know, are there possibilities for building in protection for those who need confidential care in the exchanges as well. So we're going to recognize Gail, and then we have to keep going, but I'd love for the woman standing behind you to keep her question in mind.
Say what Susan pointed out with the, if there is no cost sharing, then there really legally does not need, an EOB does not need to be generated. However, that would be extra work on the health plan, the commercial health plan, to program in who gets an EOB and who doesn't. So it's easier for them to send an EOB to everybody, even though it's not, it is not legally mandated for an EOB to be sent to everybody. It's just if there is cost sharing involved. You know, another thing that, I guess, section of the health system that we also that is for adolescent health is a big problem is regulation of billing statements in the laboratories. I mean, there is some level of regulations with the health plans with EOBs and even though they can send out a code and an EOB with codes, the language that is associated with the codes can be very vague. So really the actual service does not need to be disclosed. However, with the laboratories, there's no regulations on the who gets a bill and what it says and if a teen has a chlamydia test, then the laboratory is with full and its legal rights to send that bill home to the to the parents or the primary insured, or even if there isn't a bill and the health plan does cover it, they sometimes they'll still send these warning letters this test was done and you're going to have to pay for it if your health plan doesn't pay for it. So we have to think about reining in the labs too under some type of regulation with billing, because I think that's a big problem. We have no control over that.
Sure, and keeping our systems alive at the same time.
Exactly.
Because if they can't collect, it means they can't stay in business.
Thanks.
Carla Schmidt from Florida. And I just wanted to sort of pull all that together with the thought that with 20 years of experience with this Medicaid and lab send-home information, every time we thought we fixed it, someone else came into an office and changed it back.
Mm.
I'm very serious. This has been an ongoing, every one of the points that's been made has been reversed because of a change in someone in leadership within Medicaid or at a laboratory or someone who's just sitting at their desk and say, oh, what's that code mean? Mm-hmm. I think parents need to know. It's gone.
Yeah.
Or a governor's office, giving us a direct mandate. So even with all of the thoughts that we've had, somewhere we've got to find the solution through the mechanisms with Medicaid. I'm talking specifically to Medicaid because I don't know how we could really deal with state lab law individually with this discussion. But how with those directives and those agreements with those, cost sharing with Medicaid, that kind of information is absolutely going to be suppressed for, on a permanent basis.
So it sounds like this could be a panel of its own. There's a lot of intensity and interest on this, and I know at NIFRA we are actually going to do this at our national meeting because of the intensity and interest in this subject. I did say last questioner that was the last question, but we've got...
I cede my time.
Oh, I'm sorry,
you do? Go ahead. She's really the last one, though. Kevin, we want to give Kevin a chance.
I have a question that goes back to the safety net.
Sure.
Okay, and this is not asked as a skeptic. It's really asked... This is an honest question. When you sit down with policymakers and they're giving you a hard time about we're taking away your money and you have to leave them and you have to talk very quickly and you have three take-homes why you need a safety net, I listened to everything you said and I'm with you, but what are the two or three things, take-home messages, Bill, you or Claire, that you leave with policymakers about why we still need a safety net?
Thank you. This is in your bag. It's always good to have props. This is in your bag, which talks about the role of state and local health departments as the safety net for STDs, and it gives you, I think, four different categories of points. Because we realize that you have a finite amount of time. So this is in all of your bags. I would also encourage you, my federal policy colleague, Stephanie, is right in the back. She's got her hand up. We also have an additional fact sheet that we didn't want to put in the bag, which is specifically about money, but she can hand that off to you sort of individually. So rather than take the time to go through it, I'll just refer you to this document that we put in your bags.
Do you want to answer? Do you want to take your try?
Well, my three would be we're seeing more people than ever. There will always be people who don't have coverage and need a trusted place of high quality to go to. And three, we believe we'll be a provider of choice for sexual health care, and people deserve to go to a place that's expert in the health condition that they're trying to address.
And because I came out of the HIV world and moved into a broader infectious disease realm, and now I'm in a health reform environment, my answer has changed over time. I used to do, it's an epidemic, and, you know, it's a public health urgency, and we need these services to reach the populations most affected by the epidemic, who tend to be, and I use some soft language so I avoid saying undocumented immigrants, or inmates or other populations that they aren't going to sell. And I always try to bring it back to some youth focus, because that always sells. I have evolved to, you know, we have a complex system that different points of access for different kinds of people, and if you force everybody through one mechanism of care, people will not get it, and diseases will continue to spread, and diseases will continue to get worse, and now I always cap on, and it will cost us more. You know, so I always have to talk about the economies that come along with public health, because until I can quantify why spending now saves you that later, and later can't be more than 3 years from now, ideally by the end of the fiscal year, I get the glazed look in the eye. And so I'm forced into the business case every time, and I often end with the business case.
So we're going to ask Kevin to talk about the transition and key areas of focus for the safety net.
All right. I made some comments this morning about, you know, discretionary resources will shrink. And I've had a couple of people come up to me and say, why do you believe that, Kevin? I believe it because OMB told Bill they will shrink. OMB has been telling us this for years, in fact. In anticipation of ACA, but in the general environment that we're living in. I just want to talk a little about, you know, I use the word discretionary, and people use them differently. I've heard the language. It's discretionary versus categorical, you know, which may not, in fact, be a useful distinction in this conversation. Or discretionary versus entitlement. What, you know, services that you're entitled to under one program and another versus, or dollars that have to get spent because people have entitlements versus dollars that don't have to get spent because people don't yet have the right to those services, to use Bill's, you know, I think very appropriate framing of right. Discretionary, from my point of view, I'm a governmental administrator. I first think of discretionary as I'm free to allocate them. I have some discretion in how they get used, and they're not absolutely locked in. So they, in fact, may be categorical, but they're still discretionary. I know who can get them. I can decide to some degree through public processes who gets them, how they get them, what goes along with getting them, and what services and what kind of benefits I can reasonably expect to accrue from those. Sometimes we talk about discretionary as being targeted to specific disease entities, and that's really more the discretion, the categorical use of the term, or specific intervention types. So I just want us to be self-critical when we're using this language and in different contexts use the language differently. But why are they likely to shrink? You know, some of it is simple history. They have already. You know, in a number of our areas, we are already dealing with loss of resource because of the economic downturn, because of various congressional and other decision-making processes, and it simply is the reality. In anticipation of the Affordable Care Act implementation, learn from our experience. Medicaid expansion will have costs. It'll have costs for the federal government, and it'll have costs for the state governments. Right? So the available resources, whether federal or state, will have to come from somewhere, and it's basically a zero-sum game at this point, or even less than zero-sum game. If the ACA will be subsidizing health insurance costs for the working poor, as it does in Massachusetts, that also costs. So somebody came up to me after the session this morning and said, did Massachusetts health reform break the bank? Because I think there was some language out there that it did. In fact, it did not. It challenged our budget for a good couple of years. It was a remarkably successful program. People flooded in and wanting their health insurance in numbers that we never imagined, that none of the projections anticipated. And so we were somewhat victims of our own success. Things have stabilized considerably. And I refer you, and I'm afraid I don't have the citation to hand you, the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation has a superb monograph analyzing the economic impact of Massachusetts health reform, basically drawing the conclusion, no, it didn't break the bank. It's a shift. One of the major shifts, though, is that we eliminated the uncompensated care pool. That was a major source of resource for our health reform program, that there's no longer that pool that hospitals, health centers, and other providers can draw on when they can't get the bill paid through any other mechanism. So there, it's largely a cost shift. It did have some short-term budget increases, but things have stabilized considerably in Massachusetts. But they will shrink for other reasons. It's not just economics. You know, public policy, it is not unreasonable on its face to assume that greater health care access will eliminate the needs for certain public health funded programs, especially the zero cost programs of medical evaluation or screening or treatment or case management. And if you are not in a program that has been used to that sort of free or very low cost service payment mechanism, know you're going to get hard questions on that inevitably. And that's including those of you who only do HIV work who have been counting on Ryan White dollars for the last, how many years that's been now, since 1990. I'm not making the argument that dollars, that health insurance obviates the need for specialized public health services, but that argument will be made to you. And you need to be prepared to answer the very question that was posed to us. Give me some reasons why. And maybe it can't be as broad and as extensive as we're all used to. And we might need to be arguing for a smaller, more targeted, more focused program. I know in our STD clinic system, I didn't get to make the argument. I wasn't overseeing those programs at the time. I'm gesturing to one of my staff. I didn't get to make the argument at the time. But the argument was, if everyone has health insurance, why do we need STD clinics? And I'm afraid the folks who were involved in making those arguments didn't have the same kind of depth of knowledge of the individuals being served and the likely impacts of that, of the clinic closures. They did, however, know that a whole lot of folks who did not need that service were using it. And that was really evident from the literature. You could look at, you know, the limited economic information about the folks using the service, and there's some extremely well-resourced folks who are using the system. Again, for defensible reasons, but hard to defend in a public policy environment that's looking to spend the dollars more smart. Politically, we have actually made the case, we in public health, I hope, have consistently made the case that equitable access to health care is a social good. You know, many of us have even argued for, God forbid, you know, single-payer systems in this country. If we're going to make the argument that expanded health care access and health care financing are goods in and of themselves, we have a challenge, you know, and therefore the overall health of the population will improve if we do this. We have to stay partner with that argument even as we are making the case for the role of our discretionary resources. And I want to be clear, there is also a political power exercise playing out here, that for-profit medical providers and some very large nonprofit systems and the insurance industry itself, frankly, have the political juice to get theirs out of the system that we often do not. We often do not have enough power in the system to make the case for the relatively disenfranchised populations that we mostly advocate for. And for all of those reasons and more, I'm sure you can come up with, I think we have to be prepared to be managing a system with a lot less cash than we became accustomed to, and some of us have gotten accustomed to that already. Moving from that, that was sort of a response to some questions that I've gotten since this morning. You may take issue with that, and I really want us to talk about what are our strategies for preserving discretionary / categorical resources into and beyond 2014, because I think it's a useful conversation. I've been asked to talk a little bit about some of the transformations that we've had to undergo and that you may have to undergo. Our providers are sorely challenged, and I'm not going to sort them by family planning versus community health center versus other STD clinics, county health systems, and other safety net systems. I agree with the general definition. If you're taking the dollars, you're part of the safety net. But our providers have gotten accustomed, and the phrase we used this morning was, you know, the us being the payers of least resistance. It's not a huge transformation for them. They need a clear answer from us. No, you cannot build this contract anymore, or you can only build this contract under these circumstances. And I've seen our providers, particularly their billing offices, turn on a dime because they're used to working within those rule structures. So I don't consider, for folks who are used to billing a variety of sources, everything from insurance to Medicaid to contracts, relearning that system is not that heavy lifting for them, but you got to get the message out there. You got to get them ready for that before the moment comes, because there will be a gap if they don't. I think the bigger shift is actually in practice. And as I was talking about this morning, medical systems that you walk in the door, you see the information desk, you get sent to, you know, maybe a triage office, but often you get sent to the billing confirmation or the insurance confirmation office first, or the enrollment department first, before you get evaluated. For a number of the conditions that we're talking about in this conversation, particularly around priority STIs, we need alternative mechanisms into that very provider office. And that's a piece of work that we have not yet been successful. We're working with 8 sites in Massachusetts that are funded under contract to deliver integrated screening services and, in addition, priority treatment services for STIs and other infectious diseases. Helping them think about how to bypass their standard patient flow to get individuals into an office where they can be rapidly evaluated. And having some of it is about patients saying the right things when they walk in, but I think that's a big burden on them. In the EOD example earlier, you know, an adolescent may be able to opt out of the EOB, you know, being sent home, but they need to know what an EOB is and that they can say that and that someone won't laugh at them or humiliate them for doing so, or ask them, why don't you want your mother to know this? You know, we're asking patients to do a lot. We're trying to figure out mechanisms where either DIS personally broker this, or really do some patient education and provider education to say, when a patient comes in and uses this language or maybe presents this discrete card, we're trying to figure out ways of signaling this is not your typical walk-in off the street patient. This is someone who's coming with a specific health concern that may be eligible for our contracted services, and in any case needs a different kind of priority evaluation and treatment than the standard patient does. That's a heavy lift. I know from my work in HIV, one of the challenges we continue to have is people who go to a medical appointment who are one of our clients under our still relatively well-resourced grants, who go to a physician for an HIV concern, HIV-positive individual. Somebody comes out to the waiting room and gives them their taxi voucher, you know, because that's a reimbursable service under Ryan White and under our state rules. A medically necessary appointment for HIV concerns, you can get your transportation reimbursed. We've had multiple experiences of folks with diabetes in that same waiting room saying, where's my voucher? You know, is my office visit less important or less urgent? You know, particularly when they're getting the same similar kind of messages about the importance of, you know, regular medical care and medical management for their condition. So we have to wrestle with some of the ethical challenges of unequal service and unequal resource bases for the clients that we're advocating for, because I think there are legitimate ethical concerns. Health departments, that's where I work, and that's, you know, where most of my expertise is and where most of my function is. We're still turning ourselves inside out and upside down, thinking through how to accommodate the benefit, the absolute benefit of all this health insurance out there and the Medicaid expansion, and the loss of resources at the same time and our transformations. And I mentioned some of these things this morning about different kind of clinical training, clinical consultation function. A huge new clinical quality assurance function. I've gotten to be best friends with our Quality Assurance Bureau and have really learned tremendous things about the ways in which they can, through licensure and through example, help transform clinical practice. And so if those of you who work in health departments, whether state or local health departments, if you don't know your quality assurance folks, you're missing out on a resource, because they are, you know, they may be the bane of the existences of some of our providers, but they serve a critical function, and we often have not tapped into them because we've been able to assure quality through direct funding. There's something, you know, kind of gratifying about writing a contract, seeing a bill come in, and being have a contract manager or a data report tell us, yes, X got done because of those dollars. That was a neat little loop that we all got accustomed to. With the loop gone or the loop shrinking, we need other mechanisms to, by example, instruction, assurance, engage providers in the quality of care that we are setting as standard or that we are building off national standard. We are often can play a supplementary funding role, and that's where we're talking a bit about recognizing a subset of patients that we're responsible for because the larger health reform system is not meeting their needs. They either, despite all the availability, don't have insurance anyway. You know, one of our providers in the room tells us they see so many uninsured people, and they're uninsured for a lot of reasons. Everything from eligibility to raw, I don't have the cash, and I'm not paying that much tax anyway. So the impact of not having health insurance is a lot less. It's not unlike your organizational example, because if the penalty is this and the cost of insurance is that, people are making dollars and cents, bread and butter decisions every day. So our job to be backfilling and supplementing, but in that case we have to be very, very targeted in the messaging we give and the constraints we put upon the use of those precious few dollars. I spoke at fair length about the role of disease intervention specialists. I don't want to repeat that material, but our state workers are playing a different role on every one of those areas than they were playing before. And we sometimes throw off the language, you know, from the community health worker world of the system navigator, the health system navigator. I actually want to say they're health system brokers. They're learning the skill of helping, knowing the system, finding out where the services can be done. For example, an individual with an asymptomatic STI or a partner of an index case, who we want them to be seen today for preventive treatment. If they simply call some of their safety net providers, they may not be able to get seen that day unless they have a presenting illness. If it's a well visit, they have to wait for it. Our DAS are often playing the role of explaining why this person actually needs an appointment today and can't wait the 2 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, in some cases, for that well visit. That it's something different than what they're used to. Like, no, I'm not bleeding. No, I'm not coughing. No, I don't have a fever. But yes, I have to be seen today. And so DIS and other state workers can be playing a role brokering those communications, because we can't expect our patients to be able to do all of that self-advocacy, not in the short term. We are transforming our use of surveillance systems as well to inform the quality of our work. We are increasingly, we're not being successful yet, but improving the quality of reporting, particularly the reporting of treatment outcomes, of what treatments were applied. When we had the STD clinics, we were able to know that absolutely. It was defined by standard. It was reported to us as a function of funding. But if we're no longer funding providers in the community, we have to use our surveillance regulatory authority to derive more information than we were historically getting. It's an uphill battle, and I mentioned this morning about the limitations of laboratory data. That's often all we get from our clinical providers. We have to transform our surveillance system to be able to gather that information without creating an additional burden for the clinician to fill out a morbidity card or a surveillance case report or a treatment outcome report. It's not going to happen. There's not enough money in the system to support those additional levels of reporting. Laura Smockin from our staff actually has a poster on that very issue, our attempts to get additional information to get a sense of what's going on in gonorrhea in our state. It's depending on the facility. Across the board, there was inadequate data, and some facilities we got nothing more than what we were looking for in the first place. So our surveillance systems have to play a different kind of role collecting that information, and I've urged folks to tap into high-tech funding that's available parallel to the ACA. And let me just say a couple of other quickie examples, and then we'll go into Bill has some material as well. We're playing a different kind of role about medication access. We can't be, I mentioned the bicillin example this morning, just to repeat it quickly. You know, availability of bicillin at a range of treating providers is a serious challenge to getting priority treatment for STIs, I mean, for syphilis specifically. We are utilizing our tuberculosis pharmacies, our tuberculosis clinics that hold and purchase, store, and inventory TB drugs. They're actually doing it for free for us. The added cost of stocking bicillin is within their budgets, and they've offered to do it for free for us because they already have the systems in place. So looking for creative approaches to creating pockets around your jurisdictions of bicillin availability, and then who's going to get it to where it needs to be. In our case, we're proposing the DIS are going to play that role, and it's legal to do so in Massachusetts. We are examining right now shared insurance billing from our safety net providers, specifically the family planning providers right now, to support our public health laboratory services. A lot of providers, safety net providers included, are utilizing those precious dollars to buy commercial lab services. We can, because of our economies of scale, we can get it done cheaper and sometimes faster in our public health clinics. In our public health laboratory, but we don't have the resource base for that either. Those categorical funds are also shrinking. We are examining a mechanism where our safety net providers will bill the individual for their insurance, share the anticipated or some designated laboratory cost with the state. We'd probably have to do it through an intermediary mechanism. The example we're using for this are local boards of health that are doing influenza vaccine clinics, where they collect the insurance information on the free clinic. They are Commonwealth Medicine, which is part of our University of Massachusetts Medical School, then tabulates that and does all the respective billing from the scores of insurance providers that people are members of. Take a small, you know, administrative fee off the top and revert the bill, the reimbursement, back to the local board of health. It's the only way we're going to keep local boards of health doing vaccination clinics because, again, we don't have the adult immunization dollars anymore to keep that going. So we're using that as an example that perhaps our safety net providers could do something similar, where they're going to be maximizing insurance for the clinical services and sharing with us a share for the laboratory services to keep our public health laboratory capacity going, and I arguably save some money all the way around. Let me just hold on that point, except for one comment I got from the last session. All right, the last session was a pretty deep and dense one about mathematical modeling and complex system and chaotic system analyses. And the language I took away from that is the complex adaptive system. It's systems that can learn, where every element is interactive, where, you know, outcomes are not perfectly predictable. And most human systems are like that. Most economic systems are like that, and a lot of disease systems are like that. I'm thinking that we are in a transformational moment in a complex adaptive system around our safety net providers, where everything, the variables that are changing are money, the expectations of our services and our contracts, their billing systems, the very health-seeking behavior of our patients, the physical plants, as community health centers have grown with new ACA money, the scale of work being done by our safety net providers, innovations in the field, new science, organizational relationships that are evolving, new knowledge and skills, the biology of the organisms we're dealing with, agency mergers and closures, new research, law and regulation. It is a phenomenally complex system that we're all actively learning and responding to. The language I also learned was anticipate those phase transitions or those tipping points in those systems where suddenly enough change happens or enough variables line up that something entirely new is about to happen. I believe that's where we are with the safety net system. Something entirely new is about to happen. It may not be fully predictable, but that doesn't mean we can't be actors in that change to be able to serve a larger group of individuals with better services and better health outcomes. But we have to be really smart about all those swirling variables that surround the system and make sure that we're being as influential as they are on the final outcomes. Those are my comments.
And those last points were absolutely brilliant, so I have to pause for a moment. So I was going to talk a little bit about reimagining the roles of healthcare systems, but Kevin's just done this. I don't think he's known he's done it. But the reason I was going to conclude with just talking about reimagining the roles of healthcare systems is if Kevin and the State Department of Health is no longer providing the clinical services that they were through their categorical clinics, he just laid out a profound example for the continued role of thinking about the health department's function as part of the safety net. What we tend to think is that the safety net extends somehow between the patient and clinician relationship. But what Kevin just laid out is exactly some of the examples I was going to lay out. And one of the reasons I love presenting with you is because you're the mini laboratory we're all looking to, so it's really wonderful. But when I think about what you laid out, that's the type of work that we need to talk about, the role of health departments. And I think if we're not doing that, that is the point at which I think we lose the discretionary money. For those jurisdictions who are not doing clinical services, this is the type of work that underscores the critical role of health departments going forward. That was something. So anyway, that's how I was conceptualizing that. The one other little piece I wanted to add, though, is for those jurisdictions, what is the role of state and local health departments and the discretionary funding that they get for those who are continuing to do sort of direct clinical services? And I touched on this a little bit in the beginning, but what I want to underscore is that we must reimagine the role of the health departments even in those jurisdictions, and it begins with one. Number one is you must adapt the business model to the clinical services that you're providing. And let me be clear, I don't think you have a choice. Because if you don't show that you've made some good faith effort to incorporate billing or partnerships for billing, and you're not doing fees collection, because we have a number of studies now that show that these really aren't barriers. Kevin talked this morning that you guys charge a fee for 75, I think it was.
One of our facilities does.
Charges 75. I know the Red Door here charges a fee. You must show that you're making some good faith effort not to rely on those discretionary categorical resources, whatever we call them. That reimagines the role of the health department from the get-go. Because what it is saying is that I've at least made some good faith effort to figure out how I diversify my revenue, and I think it's absolutely essential. But Kevin also touched on the even broader piece that I think is absolutely critical, which is we have to think beyond the tumult that you've just gone through, right? That everyone is about to go through. And what is on the other side of it? Because that is where I think there's extraordinary opportunities for the role of state and local health departments as part of the safety net, in particular for STD services, which I was asked to talk about. So let me just say a few things about that. Imagine in a jurisdiction where you've got the political support to do this, a robust focus on dealing with issues of co-infection among HIV and STDs among MSM, where you are actively out promoting and training a whole new array of providers that are being reimbursed under the Affordable Care Act to do the proper screenings that gay men are supposed to be getting. Imagine the new type of work that you can be doing on the other end of that. It's new types of surveillance, and Gail laid some of this out this morning. It's new types of surveillance. It's looking at new types of disease so that we're not consistently focused on the three that we've become accustomed to focus about. But think about what a scale-up from the state and local health department would look like to deal with the health disparities that will be exacerbated if we don't get people with HPV, if we don't get people vaccinated with HPV vaccine. And the health department's critical role in doing some of that. We're not used to thinking about that because we are in such a resource-poor setting that we don't allow ourselves to imagine. Right? But I think what you've touched on going through the tumult of it is that there are lots of, that's not to say there's not a huge amounts of amazing and innovation stuff going on, but I'm asking us to think even further about what the Affordable Care Act offers for us. And then finally, I think one of the things that Gail consistently talks about is not just assessment and assurance. So is this new array of healthcare providers, there's a critical role for state and local health departments in making sure that this new array of providers are providing sexual health care services, including STD services, in a culturally competent and effective way. But what's the role of policy development, the other core function of public health that at least when it comes to STDs, probably hasn't been paid nearly the amount of attention that it should. If it had, we'd be much further along in EPT. EPT comes from the innovation that happens in state and local health departments when it comes to STDs. So imagine having, there's a reason why Gail talks about this. I mean, as far as I know, the California Department of Health was the only place where there was a policy person doing STD work. So there's a whole new array of work for us to do in these core functions of public health for those jurisdictions who are both doing the clinical services and not. So I just wanted to sort of summarize some of what Kevin said and to extend our imaginations a little bit, because if we're not, I think the cost of not doing that together and articulating and imagining what some of that looks like together is, as Kevin said, the loss of those discretionary dollars that we know are absolutely essential, but policymakers are saying, I don't believe they're for clinical services anymore. So what are they for? What are they for? And we have to have an answer for that.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Kevin. So we're going to reopen it for questions for Kevin and Bill and for, you know, me, I guess, but for them particularly, for the suggestions that they've just made. Julie, I think your name's Julie.
Julie Friedman.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if, is this on?
Yes. Yep.
Working with insurance companies so that people could get access to STD screening without a referral, that it could become like, I see people who wouldn't mind using their insurance if it covered it. But if you could find a way to say with an HMO, working with insurance companies to say, people can go in and get screened for a high risk pick for STDs. The other issue is with I know there's a lot of focus on adolescents, but I just think the last two cases of infectious syphilis that I saw, in the last 2 weeks, one was a 65-year-old man who had gone to four doctors, and he said, I have sex. And he totally was willing to use his insurance. He had no problem with that, but nobody thought of syphilis. And the other was a married man who didn't want a bill sent to his house. So both of them would have used, the example of finding a way to not send a bill to someone's house and then finding a way to work with insurance companies so people can get this. People go to the emergency room and they pay a $100 fee.
That's right.
I bet if people went to STD clinics and all they had to do was pay the $100 copay, they would go.
I think that's exactly what we were discussing earlier. If the provider institution could lay out those options for individuals. I mean, it's a simplistic model at Boston Medical Center to say, if you pay $75, we won't charge your insurance, and you get your nurse visit. You know, it doesn't pay for every follow-up, it doesn't pay for everything. But I mean, I think there are models in between, just as you were describing. You know, if you use your insurance, you're going to have to, you know, a document has to go home because that's what the law is. If you want to avoid that document, then we have to do 100% payment right now, which means you have to put it in your portion. And I'm thinking other models, I mean, as well. I've been thinking about it since I've been here at the conference. On our immunization side, we assess Massachusetts health insurers proportionally to the number of children they cover for the full cost of childhood immunizations, which we purchase under the federal contract, which is about 40% below retail. They don't actually balk at it. It's in our state budget right now, and it's likely to become permanent law. What used to be state dollars, about $50 million in state dollars, to buy childhood immunizations, because we liked distributing them. We like guaranteeing that they're stored correctly and administered correctly, and we get lots of data back about pockets of under-immunization. So we like having a state health department. I had to answer the question for an analyst, a Ways and Means analyst, why do we need an immunization program anymore since everyone has health insurance? You know, so back to the earlier question, you need to have a snappy answer for that. But there are ways in which to think about insurers freeing them up from them directly covering, utilizing the coverage and supporting state or local health systems through some sort of assessment process. This gets back to Bill's policy comment. We need to think in these meta ways about how to take advantage of a new landscape that, in fact, could be made possible by near universal coverage. So I appreciate your examples. That, you know, one of the, I wouldn't try to cover all sexually transmitted infections, but maybe we could derive a pool based on the proportion of adolescents alone and be able to maintain some unfettered access for adolescents. That would be a big step forward.
We're going to recognize the next question, but I just wanted to say that in some family planning settings, there have been packages of sexual health services that come with a cash fee so that patients are given that option.
That's right.
It doesn't happen in every setting, but it does happen in a number of settings across the country.
Hi, I'm Eileen. I work with the Title X system in California. And I'm wondering, I mean, I hear us all talking about how to work with the new medical homes, and we've got these specialty STD clinics, which in California have been closing, and those patients seem to be coming into the family planning world in California. So I'm wondering whether there's been any work done to coordinate your efforts to work with the FQHCs so that you're only asking them to subcontract with someone that's going to provide all the reproductive health services, as opposed to subcontracting with an STD clinic and subcontracting with a family planning provider.
You're asking me particularly?
No.
Anyone? Okay.
Yeah, I would say I haven't heard much about that, Eileen. And it may be because, except for this conference and Bill's conference, you know, our worlds still sit pretty siloed. And it's one of the interesting and challenging things about being colleagues in sexual health, but yet playing with different funding streams, sitting in different parts of the health department, and sitting out in service delivery in different locations. So I think it's a fantastic message. I certainly support this idea that we've heard articulated by a number of speakers that family planning and STDs could be better aligned. There's so much opportunity, and I think those partnerships will be best made locally. I can tell you that when I ran my Planned Parenthood system in New York, one of our county health commissioners approached me about taking over their STD clinic because a lot of health departments are moving out of direct service. Some of it's due to funding cuts, some of it's due to a shift in philosophy. And he came at it from a shift in philosophy, not really from a funding point of view. And he said, you know, would you, we're both working in the same city, we're looking at disproportionately high STD rates in this low-income population, do you want our STD clinic? And I was like, oh, hell yes, we want your STD clinic. You know, there are other health commissioners that would turn their back on me because of who I was and where I worked. But I think where there's opportunity for partnership, people should be talking. And, you know, it's a tough conversation, and it can be an emotional conversation to talk about who's really best prepared now to deliver services in the future. But that really is our mission call, is to assess locally, regionally, which entities are best prepared to move forward, and how can we work together to support those systems. We're going to go there for a question, and then here.
Can I just have one thing, which is I think that that's absolutely spot on, and Claire and I have had that discussion, which is I think the role of state and local health departments when it comes to STD prevention and control is to make sure the services are offered really well wherever, and in some jurisdictions that works really well. And I think the silos even, of course, they even go beyond where we are with family planning. They're perpetually deep with HIV, even where integration has happened. I was at, one of the things that we're focused on, I think that just to highlight that I think is at this system level, which is how can we coordinate at the national level at least to figure this out. So we have started working with the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, ASTO. We are an ASTO affiliate. ASTO, I represent the STD programs. ASTO represents like the head honcho, right? The head honchos of health in your jurisdictions. And a bunch of us are ASTO affiliates. The American Public Health Labs, Association of Public Health Labs, NASDAD is an ASTO affiliate, the immunization managers, the TB, the TB managers are not, but a bunch of us are who are in public health. So we have started a discussion with each other, and a survey is going out to ASTO's members to figure out, at least at the in public health, at the state level, who's billing? And I don't know if I should say this or not because it's recorded, but I was the expert in that room, which frightens the hell out of me. I shared this with Stu earlier. That frightens me because I didn't even talk about this stuff a year and a half ago. But if we can get ASTO if we can get ASTO to be working with the affiliates like us to figure out at the top level at the health department, where are you billing, what is your system like, and then we can work from the bottom up through our members to figure out how there's an alignment of not just billing, but also hopefully eventually activities and service delivery, we will save a tremendous amount of trouble and resources for everybody. But we don't even have that matrix yet at the national level to figure out. You know, I say to my members, please go talk internally in your health department to see, are the immunization people billing? It probably took you a while to figure out who was doing billing. Billing's happening in most jurisdictions somewhere. But we just don't know what that map looks like. So my hope is that at this sort of higher system level, that at least within the next 3 months, we'll have some feedback that gives us some additional opportunities to get out of some of these silos that you're talking about, and that will facilitate the work between NCSD, NASDAQ, and some of the other ASTO affiliates, as well as NIFRA.
Great. Carolyn Wester from the Tennessee Department of Health, and I've got a few questions, but first of all, I just want to thank you all for your advocacy, not only for the providers, but more importantly for the clients that we serve, and turning around and urging us and equipping us to go back to our jurisdictions and push this discussion further.
Thank
so
you.
Thank you so much. And I've got a question in the context of Medicaid. First of all, obviously we know Medicaid benefits.
Can you use the mic a little more? It's
sure.
A little hard to hear.
Obviously we know Medicaid benefits vary significantly from state to state. And being in Tennessee, we're in a state where those Medicaid benefits are very, very lean. So I guess I'm looking for some reassurance with this question. Is that in 2014, when the ACA is implemented, and hopefully the Medicaid expansion has not been overturned, will the recommendations that we're hearing, you know, whether it's USPS Task Force, supplemented by IOM recommendations and the ACIP, will those be guaranteed baseline, and that when we negotiate benefits or the states are negotiating benefits, are we talking about negotiating benefits layered on top of that? Or are we talking about those even being vulnerable? That's my first question.
Okay. You guys want me to do that one? Okay. Okay, series of answers. So when it comes to family planning and sexual health activity inside the Medicaid program, it's a mandatory benefit and has been for quite some time. So there is some built-in protection from the federal rules about family planning and sexual health. And there's some protection as Medicaid programs are looking for cost sharing. There is some cost sharing now for Medicaid patients. It's prohibited to have cost sharing for family planning services. And we define those services broadly. So screening, testing, treatment wind up in a lot of our definitions. So that's sort of the state of play now. The big variations in Medicaid for our set of services is in the income ceilings, or the categorical distinctions that are made. So you have to be broke plus pregnant, or broke plus disabled, or broke plus something else. And those distinctions are going to go away in 2014. But for those new populations coming in to the Medicaid program, there have been, there are some new sort of assertions around what they call benchmark plans, that there'll be a Medicaid benchmark plan. And those are essentially the vehicles through which the newly eligible were expected to enroll. We are hearing, or the expectation in states, is that for whatever new population that's going to become newly eligible, and in Tennessee there'll be a lot of newly eligible people, that they're likely to go into a Medicaid managed care context, not a fee-for-service context. And so the benchmark plan will go to what has to be there. So there's lots of fighting and lots of conversations going on with advocacy groups working on the feds to come out with the clearest possible guidance, and frankly, pretty directive guidance, about what should be in the benchmark. We're having similar conversations in the state exchange, because I think what wasn't clear even to those of us who are advocates on the Affordable Care Act was how closely Medicaid eligibility and exchange eligibility will be married. You know, when you think about that Expedia that a number of people talked about, an Expedia for healthcare, a web-based system, what I think wasn't clear right after the ACA passed was that Medicaid eligibility would be in the same physical place. So there's not going to be Medicaid eligibility and enrollment down at, you know, Department of Social Services and everybody else going to the web. The intention is that you go to the web. And you might route towards Medicaid based on your income, or you might route into the commercial insurance exchanges. So this benchmark idea is alive in both places. And one of our concerns from an advocacy point of view is because of the absolute furor surrounded the Affordable Care Act, it seems that the Obama administration is kind of walking back some of these very explicit, prescriptive assertions about what should be covered. There's a lot more state flexibility we're seeing. So if you're sitting in Tennessee, you're thinking, great, if my state has flexibility, they're going to do less, right? We share those concerns. And so from an advocacy point of view, we're saying don't loosen things. You've got to have a baseline. And it's got to include what the IOM says. It's got to include what the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says. It's got to include what the CDC recommends on immunization. Do not loosen that because we've pushed this far.
Yeah, and that's exactly our concern, which is, you know, we're going to lose perhaps categorical and discretionary funds and then be left with a skeleton that's full of holes.
Correct. You'll be left with full coverage.
And so that's actually kind of the segue into the next one, and this is the last one. I know that we're focusing primarily on non-HIV STDs, but I really appreciate you bringing up the HIV side of things because that's my primary focus as well. But in the context of HIV care and treatment, currently funded by Ryan White, does the ACA make any kind of provisions? Has it not even touched that yet?
Yep.
And if it hasn't, which I'm seeing you shaking your head, then I just wonder in the Massachusetts context, where you 98% of your population is insured, do your health exchanges exclude HIV-infected clients, and are they still getting Ryan White? Or have you noticed a significant decrease in demand in Ryan White services as well?
Okay, I'm going to answer your first question, last question first, and then do a couple of other statements. We have seen the benefit of ACA, and again, I'm always cautious around post hoc propter, you know, ergo propter hoc analyses, where you know something happens and something else happens, and you attribute the second thing to the first thing. But having said that, since our healthy form went into place, the growth of our state ADAP program, which we call HDAP, has not exactly stopped, but has significantly leveled off. It was looking like it was going through the roof, and we didn't know how we were going to pay for it coming, you know, 18 months out. And we bought a big gap in between what we projected and what the new enrollment is looking like. And we do attribute that to people getting their own insurance. We already had a Medicaid waiver. This is to answer your first question. We are the first state to have a Medicaid waiver for HIV non-AIDS. So income eligibility plus HIV status got you Medicaid at 200% of poverty and full drug benefit. And so that, more than any other single factor, that's the big payer of HIV services in our state, somewhere in the area of $150 to $200 million a year for outpatient HIV services, compared to the, you know, $30 million that of state and federal dollars that we put into Ryan White services, quote unquote. We also transitioned long before the health reform from a direct drug purchase ADAP program to a majority health insurance purchase system. I put that out there with some trepidation because I'm still waiting for someone to stop us. I'm waiting for someone to say, again, like the diabetes example, how come if you have HIV, somebody pays your health insurance premium, but everybody else has to cover their own? And I have an argument for that, but it's an argument that doesn't sell very well in an equitable environment. So to speak to the ACA, ACA makes it easier for states to get a Medicaid waiver, but they did not write into the ACA, though we fought for it, and added FFP, you know, and added federal share for getting that Medicaid waiver. So the cost to states may be prohibitive in this current environment. But I do know a large number of states have proceeded with moving forward on getting their Medicaid waiver to expand to HIV, not AIDS.
Wow, that is not going to happen in Tennessee. So we've just got to get that message out there as well for the Ryan White. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
But future appropriations may force the issue.
So we'll take the last two questions, and then we're going to be at time.
Mine will be very quick. Again, thank you for your thought, each of you, all three of you, for your thoughtful comments on some of where the issues in the past and where we're going. And at the risk of being a little bit redundant on what one of my colleagues as well as what Bill said about what we don't know about who's paying, I was going to suggest that we needed a survey. I'm so glad that we're working on one, Bill. But I think that at the basis of part of that is that whether or not the state law requires or exempts billing, and whether administrative code requires or exempts billing, and whether there's a system to collect it, and whether there's a perception that the collection will impede services. So as we look across the country, we know that we actually have very distinct differences on what one may bill for under the law for public services and what we're strictly prohibited from billing for.
Yeah. Well, let me just thank you for that, Carla. The resource that NCSD is working on, certainly in partnership with others, including NIFRA, that's just getting off the ground is our what we're basically calling a billing guide at this point. And the first part of that billing guide deals with the policy issue that you raise and the policy barriers that are erected in a number of jurisdictions that are either vague enough that they cause concern of billing for STD services, or they explicitly prohibit the billing or fees collection for STD services. The latter, for example, we're currently working with our partners in New York State on the revision of their law through the new state policy work that NCSD has been doing. I've also discussed with DSTDP, I know DSTDP is actually looking at trying to figure out how they create a matrix of the STD laws on this so that we have a better idea other than the models that we'll be putting into our guide of states that have already gone through some of these prohibitions and what the different laws have looked like and how they move through them. But it's an excellent point, and I don't know the answer, so we do need to figure out either through CDC or some other survey around which jurisdictions have specific prohibitions. Barbara's from Maryland sitting here in the back. I know that they're in a similar situation. Obviously, it makes no sense for me to continue to talk to Barbara about billing until we figure out the for STD services until we figure out the policy piece. So we are absolutely working on that, and I just wanted to mention that. Yeah.
Thanks, Bill.
And then there's a cultural piece here too, right? Because even if your law is permissive or there is nothing restricting you from billing, you know, we have a clinical team, in many cases a front desk staff, that is oriented towards compassion. So one of my favorite stories to tell, and sorry, Stu, I'll just do this briefly, is I was walking through one of our busiest health centers one day, and our nurse practitioner, who'd been with us 23 years at that point, came out of an exam room and just sort of, you know, I don't know why, said to me, "I'm not going to charge the patient today. I didn't spend a lot of time with her." And I thought, well, there's four people at the front desk and 20 educators in the field, and everybody here has health insurance and dental, and the lights are on, right? But that focus, which is part of what we love, is also what's part of what doesn't make us strong. So I think once you get past the policy part, which is an extraordinary challenge, particularly for STDs, on the family planning side where we're past that, we're still wrestling with our cultural issue, which is the patient can't afford it. And that's a decision that's kind of being made clinician by clinician or front desk person by front desk person. And, you know, I sat on the finance side, the administrative side of that, and that's an extraordinary challenge, is how do we make the transition so we can be there for 35,000 patients, not just for that one patient that Mickey saw that day. Dr. Berman, last question.
Well, it's... I guess it's a statement.
Or maybe statement. We love a statement. I'll give you a new graphic to make a statement.
Related to this whole billing thing, I think maybe talk a little about what the future may be and how things may come together. It's great to hear ASTO is getting involved with this, and you could imagine the future. The immunization program has wrestled with this the last 3 years. They were confronted with OMB calling them on the use of their 317 funds to pay for immunization among people who have coverage, and they did surveys and found out quite a lot of their 317 funds were used precisely in people who had insurance. Well, they can't do that anymore, but they got hold of significant amount of funds through the stimulus, through ARRA funds and through ACA funds, 20-some-odd million dollars to do both planning and implementation, and they will have in short order for all the states a pretty good information bank about, you know, what the policies are that are restrictive, who the payers are, who the big players are, who the contact individuals are for all of these, you know, the major kinds of carriers in the state. We should think about how at a state level that gets organized and take advantage so we don't duplicate those efforts. So you tackle one, you take another. Understand, you're working on one. NACHO is working for a toolkit for NCID Humanization Program, pulling together generic information. We should think about how to be coordinating so we don't stay in here in this damn silos also.
Yeah.
But you can see pretty easily at a state level, having a group, having a reference number, who's done what, and how you're not going to necessarily cross-train people. That's tricky. But each individual disease has its own codes. But knowing the resources, knowing what works, which are the software systems that work in your electronic medical record, it may be actually a pretty fast track to get that together over the next year, year or two.
Yes, Stu and I were playing out a public conversation that we've had privately. I couldn't agree with you more, again. And one of the things that we hope we're going to be able to do is to use the lessons that they have from immunization, and particularly now that the money to operationalize this has now just gone out. So we do know that there's going to be some lessons there, not just for us, but for public health writ large. And I hope that, you know, we've made ASTO aware that this is out there, and we've discussed perhaps doing some type of webinar once we know a bit more to make sure that the rest of our public health partners in the ASTO affiliate family anyway, and I've asked them to include Claire, are aware of figuring out what they figured out through immunization, how we can take advantage of it, frankly.
So thanks for participating. Please join me in thanking Bill and Kevin. Let's make our clapping louder than their clapping.
Thank you.